combined in my demodulator. Or I could look at it as one composite signal, that's the sum, the vector sum of those two signals, as it's being transmitted, and my receiver demodulates that. It converts it into a horizontal, it converts it into an in-phase and a quadrature signal, and then chooses the right box to display it. I can analyze it either way. They both work. But I can tell you that if you put a fast oscilloscope on the antenna of that 16 QAM transmitter, at one instant time, there really is one particular phase angle and one particular amplitude during that the transmission of that particular symbol. That's what your oscilloscope would see. A spectrum analyzer would not see two independent signals. It would see one signal during that period of time. You could analyze it as two signals if you want to. It really is one signal. N2XJS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Perfectly understood. So now I'm going to repeat my question again. You have a signal that bounces zillions of times from whatever the object runs. How do you preserve the polarization?
Who says you have to preserve the polarization? If my receiving antenna happens to be circular polarized, which means it'll receive a signal of any polarization, even though there's a million bounces in my neighborhood, and even though the signal may have been transmitted as purely vertical, and it arrives in my backyard as purely horizontal, my circular polarized receiving antenna will pick it up beautifully. So why must polarization be preserved? Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Thank you very much. Completely understood. That suffices my question.
Okay. We've gone down the list of people who signed in. We're about to go over to the science and physics report of Dr. Roy, but before we do, is there anyone else with a final question they want to ask us before we switch over? Give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Have you ever heard about the electromagnetic field of the Earth?
Okay. The magnetic field of the Earth is something that's always been there. By way of the Van Allen belt and whatever, that magnetic field gives us a lot of protection. Even a astronaut that's on the International Space Station, he's under the Van Allen belt. He's under the majority of that external Earth magnetic field. He's getting some protection. There are proposals to put something like an International Space Station in orbit around the moon, which means we'll now be getting a lot less, the astronauts will be getting a lot less protection, and therefore they'll get an awful lot more of the cosmic rays, solar wind, all kinds of fancy radiation will be hitting them. I don't think that's a desirable experiment to put astronauts in orbit around the moon, but there is a proposal right now to do that. Is that what you're referring to, Wes? OPUS, K2RIW?
No, it is not. I'm referring to electromagnetic field of the Earth.
Okay, give us a couple of words. Who is generating the electromagnetic field of the Earth?
Actually, it's like a chunk of information. It's not the constant one. It's how it's periodic. There is an observatory, Konrad Observatory in Austria, called ZAMG. And that is the observatory that was built without use of any metal at all, including a foundation. And they are observing changes of the very weak electromagnetic field that is coming from the core and is generated through the changes of the core inside, which would be 1,800 miles inside the Earth. And to
you. This signal that they're picking up, does it have an approximate frequency? And if there's no metal in the structure, how is the signal being sent? Is it by way of Hall effect devices? Go ahead.
Yeah. the signal has a frequency of 25 kilohertz, 35 kilohertz, and it's being picked up by a regular receiver.
Ready.
Does the regular receiver have some metal in its antenna?
That is correct.
Then there is metal in the local vicinity, but 25 kilohertz, a super low signal. You'd have to, have to have rather little metal around it in order not to be shorting out that signal that you're trying to receive, so to speak. Oh, that's a new one on me. We'll have to be listening to more about that in a future week. So, Roy, in the letter you sent me, you've got quite a number of subjects you could choose. And so you could either go down the list and have a voting and see if people have a particular question that tickles their fancy, or you can just go ahead and be the dictator and choose the subject. Choice is yours, Roy. We get very positive feedback from the presentations you make, so it almost doesn't matter. HT2GS, Dr. Roy, KTRIW in the TechNet, and here comes the science and physics section. And is this science and physics lecture number 8 or something like that, Roy? Go ahead.
Unfortunately, I haven't kept count, and if I did, I'd probably use snarky terms like Euler's numbers and pi and other kind of esoteric transcendental numbers instead of nice 1, 2, and 3. But I don't know. I'll leave it to you to count up the numbers because I don't recall them. Let me just get out of the way once again the mailbag address in case anyone actually does want to give any mailbag questions, which apparently right now no one really is inclined. It's tech@limarktech.net. Or you could just look me up, Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. I'm on QRZ. It's very easy to find my email address. And give me any questions you want, technical, amateur, scientific, anything that you want other than astrology. Let me drop.
By the way, some people will spell tech T-E-C-K, C-E-T-H, C-E-T-E-K. What is the preferred spelling of tech each time you say the word tech, Roy? Go ahead.
Use the standard T-E-C-H. It's the same one that if you go looking around for the Limark TechNet, it's the same exact way that it's spelled every place else. So we didn't get fancy with T-E-K. It's good old T-E-C-H.
Very good. So tech@limarktech.net. That's your mailbag address. Let's hope you get some more mailbag submittals. Back in the days when John, KC2, can't think of his call letters right now, KC2FDGB, he used to get as many as 75 mails per week on occasion. Over to you, Roy.
Well, I guess people just got out of the habit. If they get back into the habit, I just want them to know that there's an address that they can send it to, and I'll do my best to either answer them or give them to you or do something with them. But so far, I've been trying to come up with all this pretty much by myself. So I think I'm going to be a bit of a dictator. I'll throw out a subject, and the way people will vote on it is if they participate in the conversation or not. If they don't participate, it'll be a rather dry lecture that will be quick. If they're interested, we can go down all the little side routes and expand upon it. It worked well in the past. It worked great with the Doppler discussion, so hopefully we'll strike lightning twice. I think Eric is trying to signal us again with the beeps.
Maybe not. He usually tells us just to continue until he tells us to stop.
Sorry.
Okay, Doc, this is AC2GS. By the way, in the chat room, there are four other people, and unfortunately, our echo link is up and down and up and down, but it hasn't been feeding audio, so I think people have kind of moved away from it, and they're listening to the internet stream. So the first thing that I would like to bring up is something that was brought up in the past, so people are familiar with it, and maybe I thought we might go a little bit deeper into it and show that other things that we talk about are interrelated to other things that we talk about. and it's all just one big universe. So what I wanted to bring up is something called Olber's paradox. Now, it goes way, way back to Kepler's time. You know, the big question was, you have this universe, supposedly it's an infinite universe with an infinite number of suns, stars. Why the heck is the night sky dark? Shouldn't it be lit up like the sun itself? So does anyone out there have any kind of ideas, surmises, or reasons that they would like to volunteer? And please, I do not bite, so, you know, come one, come all.
A VDH with a comment?
Yes, comment away, VDH.
Well, I think that the condition is that because there is a region where there are no more stars further out, therefore the sky wouldn't have a uniform background glow, that that it doesn't actually extend to infinity, or as at some point the stars are moving away at such a speed that we can't see the light from those stars. Go ahead.
Okay, those are both two very good reasons. But if you think about it, well, you kind of put it all together into one reason, but it's really sort of two reasons, and then both very good. One is that some of the stars are traveling so fast away from us that they're being redshifted out of our visible light view. And the other is that some of the stars have not reached the light cone where it's part of our observable universe. Just because it's in the universe doesn't mean that we can see it. It has to be within our light cone. And that kind of indicates a very, very interesting aspect, at least for me, that even if you might want to say that the universe is infinite, because that's up to argument, it demonstrates that time is not infinite. Because if time was infinite, then we would have an infinite light cone going all the way back to infinity, and even though it was redshifted, there'd be other things going on. So, yeah, those are two very good reasons, that it's redshifted, and a bigger reason because the universe is made up of a finite amount of time.
I'd like to add a couple of words to this one, really. What NASA did when they took the ultra-deep field picture, they realized that the people running the International Science and Space Telescope, the group in Maryland that's in charge of selecting the targets for Hubble Space Telescope, declared for themselves a few years ago 1 million seconds of time, which is something like 10 days. So they decided to choose what they thought was the darkest place in the universe they could think of. It was a place not too far away from the Big Dipper, where it's a very dark region. So they aimed the telescope in that direction for 10 solid days. I'm not saying it was a 10-day exposure. It was a whole lot of individual exposures over a period of 10 days, and they added them all together. They expected this to be a very dark picture. They thought they might see a couple of stars in there. What that picture shows, that ultra-deep field picture, is 2,600 galaxies, where each galaxy has, on average, 100 billion stars. 2,600 galaxies that had never been seen before, because the light was so dim, they're so far away, that until you gather those photons, let me drop that great big mirror on the Hubble Space Telescope, on some of those galaxies, is gathering one photon every 10 seconds, so to speak. But you do it for a million seconds, and you get a whole lot of photons, and it finally sums up as a picture. So that picture, 2,600 galaxies that had never been seen before in a place that they thought was dark, and the amount of sky they were scanning is equivalent to you holding a soda store at arm's length and looking down that soda store. That's how much sky they were looking at. As such, you see that, assuming that that particular picture is typical of the whole sky, what's really going on is that there's a zillion stars in every direction you look, but some of them are very far away, very dim. Until you gather a whole lot of photons, you won't even know they're there. This is even before you go to the super redshifts. That Hubble's picture was not looking at super redshifts. They're just looking at the primarily visible stars. So as I see it, the sky is white everywhere. Let me drop. The sky is white everywhere. You just have to define what white is. If you use the right instrument and you gather enough of those photons over a long enough period of time, there is apparently no dark portion of the sky. That Hubble Deep Field picture, they duplicated that now four times in a row in four different directions. They got essentially the same answer all four times. So there is no dark area. There is, the sky is white everywhere. Depending how you define white, you have to use a sensitive enough instrument with a big enough of a bucket gathering those photons. And so your eye is not sensitive enough. You think the sky is dark in a lot of regions. You need a more sensitive eye. Hubble is doing that for us. And the James Webb Space Telescope, when it goes up in a year and a half, it's going to do a much better job of it. That's a bunch of opinions. AC2GS, K2RIW, good, right?
And in a way, I agree entirely with you. And surprisingly, it's not one of the standard answers given. But I would kind of use a different set of semantics. I wouldn't say the sky is white. I would say the sky is probably best described as very, 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 very dark gray, in that there is a lot of light that we can't receive. But this sort of goes around to last week when you weren't here. We talked about both why the sky is blue and why the sky isn't really blue. And it's perceptions that are important to people, at least. And it's the perception of light that's problematic. Surprisingly, our retinas are capable of picking up a single photon of energy. The trouble is, the retina's rather too smart for us. There's a time rate limitation. If it doesn't receive enough number of photons in a given number of milliseconds, it throws the information away. And so what's happening is that as you go farther away, because photons are granular and quantum states, what happens is the light blinks, and so you get a photon, then you get nothing, then you get a photon, then you get nothing, and we don't see the blinking because we're not designed to see single photons blink at too slow a rate.
Yeah, I listened to the recording of what you guys did last week. Good stuff. And when it comes to Rayleigh scattering, the sky looks like it's blue. On a clear day, the sky looks blue to a human eye. The sky really is blue. Is it blue, violet, indigo, indigo, violet? It's even beyond indigo. Rayleigh scattering, it really means that the individual oxygen and nitrogen molecules that are in that air, those individual molecules are very small compared to the optical wavelength your eye sees. Therefore, every wave hitting one of those nitrogen or oxygen molecules scatters in all directions. But because the scattering device, the molecule, is so small, it favors the higher frequency better. I think it's a T to the fourth power, so to speak. In other words, diameter to the fourth power determines how much echo you get off of that nitrogen or air molecule. So the signal is being scattered by the air molecules. Let me drop. Is really very deep violet and beyond, probably ultraviolet. However, the human eye has a passband to it. When you look at the eye reception, it looks like a Gaussian-shaped curve, and the curve of your eye's response is falling off very fast as you go beyond higher frequencies than blue, shorter wavelengths. So your eye sees blue because that's where you've got some sensitivity. That signal scattered off that clear sky is really deep into violet and ultraviolet, I believe, Roy. I wonder if you see it that way. See it that way is a funny way of expressing it. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think when you actually line up the amount of light energy across the visible spectrum, at least, it peaks around green. The sun gives off the most frequency in the green range. But it does it all the way into ultraviolet, and that's how we get suntans. If it didn't do ultraviolet, you wouldn't need suntan lotion, and you wouldn't have all those problems at the beach. But that's the problem. human perception is an incredibly interesting thing to me. Maybe it's medicine, maybe it's just science in general. There are things that we call colors that people don't really appreciate that don't truly exist. I mean, I'll give as an example, I'll mention a couple of colors, and I'll ask the audience if they can tell me which ones are true colors that have a particular frequency of emissions and which are just perceptions on human beings' part. Okay? Indigo, purple, pink, and brown. So I'll throw that out to these to everyone. Please jump on it and tell me what you think.
Indigo, purple are true colors. I think pink and brown are false.
Okay. Anyone else want to give their ideas?
Kilo Yankee 2, Mike Yankee, indigo, true color.
Okay, Gene, what about the others? Do you think they're true or false?
False. I believe they're only three primary colors.
Oh, they're not three primary colors. You're getting back to human perceptions. We have retina cells that read red, green, and blue, but there's nothing special about those three colors except that they're nicely divided across the visible light spectrum.
Okay, didn't know that.
Anyone else want to guess, suggest, or tell me which one of those colors are real and which are kind of make-believe colors?
82 MSD, I'm not sure if I'm going to answer your question, if I could.
The indigo color is the most controversial one. It's intuitive color in our perception. Attraction.
Okay, also, about five people tripled, quadrupled, what have you. I heard AC2IS. You wanted to make some statement or ask me a question about the question?
Yes, I mean, I think that what you're asking, or maybe what you want to ask, is, you know, which colors are, quote-unquote, single-frequency colors, you know, pure single-frequency colors. I think there are colors like, you know, purple that you might not think of as a real color, but I mean, it can be represented by a combination of frequencies, but maybe not a single frequency. So I ask.
And what I'm trying to divide as best I can, the concept of human perceptual color and a physics answer of a frequency that emits a given color, which are two different things which people conflate as one solid thing. If you ask an average person and they thought about it at all, they'll pretty much tell you they're all colors, and someone once told them they have to something to do with frequency, and so they're all frequencies. So there's a frequency for brown to some people. Other people, I guess they would just not even know about frequencies. But that's what I'm trying to get at. The incredible difference between a human perception of color and physics nature of different electromagnetic frequencies. I'm going to guess.
So, you know, according to that, I would say, yeah, brown is not a single frequency color. Also, violet is an interesting one, right? Because it is a single frequency color, but it actually it excites two receptors in the human eye. So, that's kind of an interesting one. AC2IS.
Toshin.
You wanted to say something.
In terms of frequency, purple is a color that is between blue and red. And it is similar to violet, but it's unlike violet. And it does have a spectral color with its own wavelength, which would be the visible spectrum of light. So my understanding is all of the colors, they are represented by one single frequency. As far as indigo, is intuitive. it relies on from feeling. So you may say deep midnight blue, but you may say blue as violet, and holds attributes of tricolor, centurion.
It might be helpful, Roy, if we talk about looking at a signal being analyzed on a spectrum analyzer. Does the spectrum analyzer show one blip or multiple blips? Is there really one frequency there, one wavelength there? And because the human perception system is doing what's called simultaneous amplitude comparison, you've got some red cones, green cones, and blue cones. When you're looking at something that's violet, for instance, you're getting a certain amplitude out of your blue response. You're getting a slightly lower amplitude out of the red response. The human brain puts it together and says, I'm going to call that violet. But I think violet could be one particular wavelength that's above the blue. It's higher in blue in frequency than our blue, but because our red has got some overlapping Gaussian curve to it, and we're getting some response out of at least those two, we get a certain perception of color, but there are times when we can really be fooled. And Mr. Polaroid, with his photography systems, really used that to his advantage. AC2GS, K2LAW.
And some addition. I just found the indigo is 450 to 220 nanometers, which is, when I said one single frequency, that would be one single frequency within the bandwidth. So we understood that there are plenty of frequencies representing similar colors to indigo, color between 450 and 420.
I mean, I admit that I see a little bit each box, but I have a reason picking indigo. But if you want to substitute it with violet, so be it. But the question originally was indigo. But any other comments, observations, or questions? What question or comment do you have?
Just wondering where you may have or green, or whether or not a misconception based on the fact that you need more greens than anything else.
Not quite sure of exactly what you were saying because you dropped in and out. It's true that human vision is more sensitive to green, but also there's a little bit more amount of green light in sunlight if you look at it across the spectrum. That's what people tell me who do a lot of research in that type of field.
The sun may be putting out a very strong signal at green, but when that signal is, and the signal coming out of the sun is very a broadband signal, way beyond infrared to way beyond ultraviolet. The sun is putting out a lot of signals, but it's got a certain curve to it, and the curve peaks around green. But the green is not reflected with as much amplitude off of air molecules because of Rayleigh scattering characteristics, because the molecules are so small, smaller than the wavelength, you get a bigger reflection of those molecules in the blue and violet region. You get a bigger reflection than you do from green. Therefore, you see sky as blue because of the stronger reflection of that, even though that's not what the sun is putting out. Not all of what the sun puts out is being scattered, and the particular scattering of those air molecules favors the higher frequencies, the shorter wavelengths. That combined with the passband of the human eye, put it all together, we see it as blue. I'll bet you it's stronger in violet than it is in blue if you had the right kind of instrumentation as to what sky reflection really is, sky scattering. That's a bunch of guesses. Over to you, Roy, KQLAW.
Yeah, I totally agree. There's a little bit over-absorption of ultraviolet that kind of diminishes it to an extent, but the scatter is blue and violet, And as I mentioned before, we have a very interesting retina that cuts a lot of corners because we have three receptors, red, green, and blue. We have tricks that our brain and our retina uses to figure out colors that are a little bit off of those ranges. And one of the ways that we tell violet is we look for blue, and then we also look if there's any kind of bleed into the green receptors, because if it's a pure blue, the nature of our photoreceptors is we'll give you a little bit of a signal on the green channel. If it sees nothing on the green channel, it then interpolates it as violet and tells you that it's violet. The way that you trick it is you give it a little blue light, which bleeds into the green and gives a false green signal, and your brain goes away with it being a lovely light sky blue.
I think I have read, Roy, that there's a very small percentage of the human population that doesn't have just three sets of cones, they've got four sets of cones. And I think there's a small number of yellow cones on some human vision. Is that approximately true? K2LIW?
Yes. I mean, for the most part, it's insects in lower life that are tetrachromic, that have four color receptors. It's an aberration that human beings and gorillas and chimpanzees have trichromic three color receptors. Most mammals can only see two colors, and that's why I mentioned last week that you could wave a red flag in front of a bull from today until next Wednesday. He doesn't really care because he doesn't see red. So, I would agree with that.
What are the two colors that a bull sees?
I tend to think it's a very similar to the problems that colorblind people have, where they cannot discern the difference between red and green. So, red and green kind of look roughly the same, and it's just blue and green receptors that are firing. That makes it very problematic for traffic lights, which have always in the past been coded red and green. Thankfully, they've changed that a little bit, but that was a big problem for a long, long time.
I'd like to believe a person who is partially colorblind is looking at the position of the bright light as a way of knowing, is it red, green, or blue? I think red is always on top and green is always on the bottom. Over to you, Roy.
That's the trick that most people learn very, very quickly. And there are interesting glasses that do interesting color filtration that give people slightly better cues what colors that they're not able to see might be. And people actually, there was a Korean company, I forget which one, that went heavily into a four-color displays. They not only had the red, green, and blue, but they also had a yellow pixel, I think primarily for marketing, and that 0.0002% with that mutation to their visual receptors.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Bravo Zulu.
Yeah, this is Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu. Rich in Riverhead, can you hear me?
I do.
Just getting the last part of the response. If you can, I want to, if I can, I was thinking about this all week in with what you guys talk about and the physics part of it, and that's called LSD, the drug LSD.
Lysergic acid.
Yeah, let me make a suggestion to all of you guys. Every one of us has got to squeeze the mic button. Wait a half a second before you talk. An awful lot of the conversation, I'm only hearing the second half, so to speak. Each time Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu signed in, we heard 2 Bravo Zulu. Quite often, Roy, we miss the first syllable of what you say because you're a little bit fast on the talking versus pressing. The machine's a little slow to respond. It's not our fault, if you know what I mean. So each one of us, if you want everyone to hear the first syllable, wait a second before you start talking. Back to you, Roy. K2LIW.
Okay, I'll try to be a little bit slower with the reflexes. So, W2BZ, is this particular question about what we're discussing now? Because if it's not, I'll open questions if we have time later on, and we can discuss lysergic acid if you're so inclined.
No, it's exactly about what you're talking about. You know, I went to college, you know, in the late 60s, so I did try it a couple of times, and I saw color come out of a television set and flow down onto a floor, for instance.
Yes, well, sergic acid, and there's a whole bunch of different mushroom chemicals that produce both visual and auditory hallucinations. And so you can see, quote, colors that you never saw before. And there are people with interesting neurological phenomena that see sound and hear images. They have a little crossover in their brain that's really not supposed to be there. That keys in different senses for different stimuli that aren't designed for them. So it's a curiosity, but I'm sure if you look in the literature, there's lots of people who tell you, I forget the term offhand, but they can see music, and they can other people can hear images.
I've read that there are some people that when they look at individual letters of the alphabet, printed in black and white on a white piece of paper, those individual letters have particular colors. When they look at that letter, they see a particular color. These psychedelic effects are pretty weird. Cross-coupling between our senses. I've got a crazy one, Roy, that I told to a lot of people. Even my eye doctor, he's never heard of it before. Let me drop this. I have a lot of trouble when somebody wants to put eye drops into my eye, or when I want to put eye drops into my eye. It's quite difficult for me to do it. To hold my eye open, my eye really doesn't want that foreign object dropping into the eye. However, whether the doctor does it or when I do it, when that eye drop finally does drop into my eye, for the next one full second, I hear a deep rumbling sound. When an eye drop touches my eye, it excites a phony audio, deep rumbling sound that lasts for about a second. And as I said, when I tell my eye doctor about this, he says, I've never heard of that. Over to you, Roy, KGRIW.
AC2GS. Well, likewise, I'm sure. That's an interesting cross connection. It always intrigues me. We really know so little about how the brain works. It is an incredibly complicated thing, and we tend to look upon it like a lot of people think the visual cortex is just like a film studio where an image is just being projected off the rear portion of our brains and being seen by something inside. But it's being translated and compressed and things that JPEG and MP3 could only dream of. There's a lot of tricks that biology uses to get signals down to a very, very low symbol rate. See, we got around to symbol rate again on this. Everything is interrelated. So, you know, it's always amazing to me when I hear the description of especially illusions, because images that we perceive incorrectly are because we're using mechanisms that the brain has evolved to use to get around things and make it easier. And most of the time it works, but occasionally it doesn't. And things that are the same size look bigger to us, and all kinds of illusions are possible optically.
Hey, Mr. Jack.
Yes, Eric.
All right, I'm finished. It winds up I have a bad port on a controller. Seems like I'm enjoying listening to hum now. And by the way, most of the things biologically are very much parallel processing, so, you know, you can have wide words at very slow rates.
Yeah, I mean, the brain is the ultimate parallel processor. Neural circuitry is cross-connecting a large number of individual processors simultaneously, and that's why we do great pattern recognition and not so good symbol manipulation.
I agree. Now, also, the way that you study anatomy, or you've studied anatomy, It's very rare that you see a single nerve fiber doing all the work.
You're quite correct. It's done by a large number simultaneously, some of them doing slightly different things, and that's why a lot of brain injuries are not very obvious at first, because there's a lot of error correction and a multipath and other things going on that confuse the deficit, unless it gets rather large. You could knock out a good it's almost like holography. It's kind of diffusely imprinted around our brain, so you have to knock a big chunk out to have a significant deficit, unless you pick those little points where everything comes together. Then you're just out of luck.
No, I totally understand. But I understand in our world, actually, things like MPEG and JPEG and all that stuff, it's totally reliant on fast Fourier transform. What we basically do is take it from the time domain, put it into the frequency domain. You can actually reduce and lose a lot of information, but the coefficients that are left over allows you to reconstruct it. That brain is something different.
But ultimately, you're going back to psychoacoustics and the way the brain processes sound. And they've figured out the bits and pieces that aren't that important and thrown them away.
No, we do that in math all the time. No, I'm deaf. I don't hear anything over 1,000 hertz of what I do here. It's not in great condition, and due to nerve deafness, so the upper ends of my cochlea is basically dead. So, interestingly enough, my brain can discover stuff that's happening high up by the harmonic resonance that it creates with stuff down low.
I mean, one of the many things, brains are clever little devices, and if they don't get enough cues the way that they're designed, sometimes they're a little plastic enough to go looking for not obvious clues and then kind of amplifying them in the recognition systems of your brain. And so a lot of times people will hear things and comprehend things and sense things that on some levels they're not even aware of. Sometimes it could be very subtle where you get a sense, that's one of those things where people says, I feel it in my gut. Well, you're probably feeling it someplace else, but it's not kind of reaching straight into your conscious. It's kind of giving it hints around the edges.
TCQIS, come in.
I'm not going to monopolize it, but folks that have tinnitus, they don't have to understand where that tone is coming from.
No, it's basically a noise introduced bioelectronically and probably can be along the entire chain, and no one has a good feel for that. There are things that they try. Basically, they try to just pound the white or pink noise to kind of jam the system, but that's one of the many things that a lot of people who don't have it don't quite understand how incredibly maddening it can be, but I've known more than enough people who could be driven really mad by that buzzing or whatever they hear.
Which leads me to an interesting question. Cochlear implants, now, how do they make the spectrum appear across that nerve bubble?
The understanding I have of cochlear implants that it's not quite a perfect solution. There are some inherent deficits post-insertion. One of them I understand the people's ability to kind of comprehend or make sense of music is dashed to hell. There's always the odd guy that doesn't notice the difference. But it's not the same as hearing, unfortunately. It's a boon to people who that's the, best thing that they could do for themselves. But, it's sort of a much more mature and technically useful than what's being worked on for fake eyeballs that are giving little 8x8 arrays of electrodes in the back of your occipital cortex. So it gives you something to work with, but it isn't the same as the good old thing.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
pick up the other station, but we got the signs. Maybe you can explain how the nerve interface works in a cochlear implant, or even in a visual implant.
Okay, great. I'll pencil it in. Unfortunately, for the visual, it's very, very early days. It's really, they're just taking matrix of electrodes, sticking it in a sensitive part of your visual cortex, and trying to it's probably one of those techniques where they keep you awake when they plant it, so that they find a nice region where you'll notice the difference when they light up or don't. But okay, I'll pencil it in for the future. W2BZ wanted to say something, and then also AC2IS wanted to say something. So BZ first. Oh, well, I guess if he doesn't want to say anything, AC2IS, did you have something you wanted to say?
Yeah, this is AC2IS. It's interesting the expression of gut feeling, because there are actually, I think, more nerve endings in, you know, more neural matter sort of in your gut, in your midsection, if you add it all up, than in your brain. I forget what they call it. It's a separate sort of vagus nerve system that I think is responsible for transmitting a lot of this kind of feelings that you have in your gut and other places in your brain. So, you know, having a feeling in your gut is, I don't know if people always use that expression to refer to those things, but, you know, those things do exist and are real.
Okay, there's a whole bunch of little things there. There's two parallel secondary nerve systems, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic, which control a lot of automated features in our body that our brain doesn't want to be bothered with. It has a little feedback mechanism, but it's not directly linked to your conscious self, so you can't make your adrenal gland squirt. So those are the sympathetics and parasympathetics. They run in the abdominal cage. I don't know if I'd call it gut, but, you know, gut is a kind of a loose term. The vagus nerve is a nerve that runs from your cranial nerve in your brain down and feeds a bunch of places, including your diaphragm. So that's the vagus nerve. As far as nerves, you have to also talk about sensory versus doing something. The sensory nerves, if you ever see, there's a nice little diagram of the side of a body where a lot of sensory nerves are clustered in your hands and in your lips and other little bits and pieces of your body, and large trunks have very little nerves. Those are sensory nerves that feed into your brain. I still think that pound for pound, the biggest amount of nerves, dendrites and what have you, are in your brain proper. But there are nerve cells that do all kinds of interesting things in the human body.
This is AC2IS. I think you know, there's a greater nerve density in the brain, but for things like peristalsis to work, there's a lot of neural activity in your gut just to keep your digestion working. And I think that if you... since that area is kind of larger in your brain, if you add all that stuff up, supposedly you get more neural material spread throughout your body than you have in your brain. AC2IS.
AC2GS. It's kind of potato-potato once again. The brain is the great controller. Nerve cells are all over your body because every time you feel anything, any time you do anything, you're eliciting nerve cells that are running either from sensory devices on your skin or muscles actuating movement. There's all kinds of senses. I'm sure everyone's heard of the five senses, but that's the good old Greeks and their mistakes. There's a lot more than five senses. We sense temperature. We sense pressure. We sense position. We sense a whole bunch of things, and we have these receptors and these sensory fibers that are basically organic versions of wires that that plug mostly into our brain. But again, some go to the parasympathetic chain, some go into the sympathetic chain. It doesn't really require that much brains to manufacture peristalsis. It's a kind of a reflexive thing. The heart also has a couple of nerve cells that it uses. So nerves are all over the human body. It would be kind of difficult to find a place that they don't exist.
7-4.
Yes, Eric.
So, the separation between, well, I guess we call the autonomic nervous system and whatever is connected to consciousness. Some people, like I know if I sit and I do a certain thing in terms of my thinking, I can slow my heart rate down and make my blood pressure drop a little bit. Not by much, but if I concentrate on it, I can control or aid it with my heart is beating. Although, you know, the way the QRS propagates through the heart, that's all done locally inside. How can thinking, or whatever it is that you might call it, have an effect on it?
In the case of the heart, it doesn't affect the QRS complex, which, as you said, is a concept that takes place in the AV node of a human heart. What happens, and we get back to that vagus nerve that Bill mentioned, is one of those things that comes down from the brain and touches the AV node, and what it can affect not is the QRS complex, but it can affect the timing interval. It'll increase or decrease the timing interval. It could overdrive it. That's why if you're frightened, all of a sudden your heart races. That's a completely emotional response. It's not a physiological response to anything that's assaulted you. You're afraid, the heart rate goes up. So it's the rate that's under control. And there's a lot of ways that we can kind of get around the back door of all these autonomic functions. There's just no direct switch for most of us. And if you put in a lot of training, sometimes you could find a secret little switch someplace. But it's not obvious, and most people never see it, and most people can't use it. But there are ways to game the system to a degree.
I hear you. Well, there was a period of time where I was totally deaf. By the way, I do most of my listening with my eyeballs when I'm with someone, so the radio is sort of a hard thing for me. You know, somebody might be talking about a train, I think they're talking about a plane. I mean, there are certain sounds that are precisely the same, and I don't get any of the sibilance, so I can't separate them. But the point that I'm getting at is that the acuity of my vision improved greatly over most people. You know, there seems to be compensation of other senses.
AC2GS. Yeah, I've heard that, but every time anyone really tries to study it, they don't really find any firm evidence. I think it's not actually the acuity as much as it is the ability to take what you get and do a little bit extra with it. If you put in effort, you know, I know people who use hearing aids and they can hear very little. But they pretty much reconstruct conversations in their head. It takes a lot of processing in the brain, and some people are able to do it and other people aren't. But again, it's fascinating that I think people with problems with one sensory organ become very adept at utilizing every last bit of another sensory. I don't think it's quite the same as your acuity improving. Like, I don't think you have 15-20 a vision in both eyes because of your hearing problem. That would be an acuity improvement.
Now, I gotta admit, now that I'm getting older, it's getting lousier. But, no, when I was younger, I'd go to the eye doctor, and it would be, like, better than 20-20, and he'd be like, how'd you do that? You had to memorize the charts, you know, because there's no direct way to do that kind of measurement other than the feedback that you provide.
And there are some people who are 15-20. The average is 20-20, but there are guys out there, And every so often, people who go for the laser treatments will jump around and say that their vision is even better than when they were kids. And that might be true, but then also those types of surgeries can screw around with your night vision. So the universe takes with one hand and gives with another. But I've heard a lot of anecdotal stories of people with hearing problems and their vision is more adept and vice versa. I just haven't seen any hard and fast evidence over a large enough number that it doesn't amount to an anecdotal demonstration.
Yeah, I can follow that, Chris. I mean, the reality is that your experience of life teaches you things. And, you know, how you deal with whatever input you have, you try to utilize to the fullest. It's not a conscious effort on your part, but that's what seems to happen. But to make an empirical measurement of that, I think would probably be rather difficult. Because there is no standard for human beings. Everyone's somewhat different.
Yes, that's the problem. And every time I ever went into a car shop and they had the big sign out that said, you know, doctors only have two models to deal with. We have hundreds. I thought that was a little disingenuous because every person is just a little bit different. Enough to make it either interesting or complicated, depending upon the way you look upon the universe.
JMP, quick comment.
Comment away.
I heard of a mechanic who said something to that effect, and the doctor replied, when I go in, the engine's still running.
Okay, that's as good a reply as any. I never actually had anyone quote it to me. They had the posters up, and I didn't think it was going to be useful to have a discourse on the subject, so I just let it sit there on the wall.
SRL, at any rate.
Well, anyway, I'm curious about, if you're aware of cochlear implants, where do they actually make the connection, and what's the interface?
Well, obviously the interface is electronic. There's inductive circuits that connect the outside to the inside. And I would assume that there's some kind of electronic sensory equipment that's just someplace planted in the cochlear itself on the part of the fibers that are still alive and working.
So what you're really saying is that people with a cochlear implant in fact have a working cochlear. They may have a problem with the mechanical connection, the nerves and the bones that make the connection to the oval window?
It's probably a degree of damage. I don't think anyone with a totally destroyed cochlea from the beginning to the end can use one. But I don't think it requires a completely healthy cochlea to give enough of a signal to interpret. That's just a cursory view because I've never really done a great deal of research in cochlear implants because it kind of falls out of my, you know, I'm a general internist. So we learn less and less about more and more until we know nothing about everything. But that's what little I know about cochleas, and I've talked to people who've had them and such. But I'm more than happy to look it up and do it one of these nights.
Does a cochlear implant include a battery? Is the amplification involved, Roy?
I believe that the power is inductively coupled from the outside.
I was going to say that's all external. I know a couple of people with it. And it's basically a coil on one side of the skull and a coil on the other side. It's connected to the gear.
So there really is an external hearing aid with a battery feeding a signal to a coil, and that coil then transmits through your cranium into the other coil that's inside your head. So I think there's a battery and amplification involved. Is that your understanding, Eric?
Yeah, well, it's all hearsay from my knowledge of it. I kind of always avoided it psychologically because, you know, I live my life the way I live it. And, you know, if I could all of a sudden hear
frequencies that I can hear, that would be pretty strange for me. But I mean, I got to admit that there is something to taking. I did, when I was working for the university, I did a couple things. This is at the time before DSPs were readily available the way we see them. This is back in the 1800s.